not three hookers or whatever up in his vicinity, but no, I didn't. I...
Arthur, this is just to Roger. Thanks for the information, sir, and I'll get back to you if we come up with anything, over.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. I am Tanner. I'll be one of your hosts today. First, I just want to thank you for all of your support. Taylor and I are both really happy to make something that people want to listen to. It makes it very easy to research and do this every week when we know that people are enjoying it and listening to it. We always enjoy interacting with all of you on social media. We like reading those comments, getting feedback from you. So on social media, we can be reached on Twitter at @beyond_breakers, on Instagram at @beyondthebreakerspodcast, through email, beyondthebreakers@gmail.com. We also do have a Patreon that we are trying to promote a little bit more. We want to keep the show ad-free. That's the kind of show we like to listen to for podcasts, so we want to do the same for ours. But if you think what we do is worth a few of your hard-earned dollars, throw a couple of those at us on Patreon. The money from Patreon just goes back into the show, research material, web hosting fees, things like that. Things that keep the show good, keeping it at a high quality, as everyone wants it to be. So think about all of those things. While you're doing that, I will introduce my co-host for today, Taylor. Taylor, how's it going?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
Pretty well. I mean, ever since the Bucks won the NBA championship.
I was going to say, I think last time we spoke, I think Bucks and six is what we were hoping for, and Bucks and six is what we got.
It was really cool. It was really cool as a sports fan, as someone who identifies as a Wisconsinite. It was really cool, and it remains really cool. I think every day I wake up and I still think, like, oh, the Bucks have another game to play, or the Bucks have another series to win.
It's fun seeing a team in like the modern, like the way things work in modern sports. It's fun seeing a team build a team around a player and actually develop from being the worst team in basketball to a championship caliber team.
It's very cool. Giannis seems very cool. I've never spoken to him personally, but he seems very cool. Seems very likable. Yeah, it was a very cool experience, and I can only assume that the Brewers will replicate that result in the World Series this year.
Well, speaking of cool experiences, let's talk about an uncool experience if you were in the Australian Navy.
Extremely uncool is probably the most mild way you could describe this. Very uncool. Australian Navy, we're putting you on notice. Very uncool. So today, before I get into the real hardcore details here, let's talk about a little bit of background. So the ship we discussed today, we're going to be talking about the post-World War II era, kind of that time in military history between the Korean War and Vietnam. So we're talking about the Daring class of destroyers.
Okay.
The Daring class. These were the largest ships ever built in Commonwealth nations to be classified as a destroyer. These are used by both the Royal Navy and the Royal Australian Navy. So the idea here with these with this class of ships was to kind of fill the role of what you would think of as a cruiser from World War II.
Okay.
Something that was a little bit bigger, but kind of rendered obsolete with some of the new technology changes that were, you know, coming forward here. This class of destroyers is interesting for the more military inclined. This is the last destroyer to really use guns as its primary armament. I'm not much of a naval, you know, military history person post 1800s, so this is all kind of new stuff for me. But that does seem very interesting. This is kind of our last ship that is using guns as its main weapon, rather than the missiles that will come later.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things, like you said at the beginning there, when you're in those interwar periods between, like, the Korean War, which has much more in common with World War II and what you think of, mm-hmm. versus Vietnam, where you begin to see a lot of the beginnings of the technologies that we're still using today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting time in history, those transitory periods. So in this class, this daring class, 11 were built overall. 3 of these were for the Royal Australian Navy. The rest were for the United Kingdom. One of them does still survive today. The HMAS Vampire.
That's a fun name.
It's a very fun name. That's one thing I will say for this class of ships. They had really cool names. The other two, their sister ship for the Australian Navy. One of them was the Vendetta. Again, another really cool name.
Right.
That could be like a pirate ship.
It does. It does be a pirate ship.
And the focus of today's episode, the Voyager. The Voyager. 390 feet in length, or 120 meters, with a beam measurement of 43 feet, or 13 meters, and a draft of 12 feet 9 inches. She had a top speed of 33 knots. Since we're talking about a military vessel, I figure I would include the information about the armament here.
Yeah.
I don't know that much about small guns that you can hold in your hand. I certainly don't know anything about big guns that you would put on a ship. But it had 6 4.5-inch Mark V guns in 3 twin turrets. It had 6 40-millimeter Bofors in 3 okay. twin mounts. And it had, it was armed with 10 torpedoes from 21-inch Pentad torpedo tubes. And the coolest sounding thing to me, I have no idea what this is, but it sounds really awesome. It had a triple-barreled Limbo anti-submarine mortar. Mortar seems like a strange thing to target a submarine with, but I'm totally here for it. That would be really cool, I think.
Yeah.
It'd be fun to play with, at very least. That's kind of what we're dealing with here in terms of the hardware. This ship had a crew allotment of 320. That includes 20 officers, although that's the wartime capacity, kind of maximum strength in terms of crew, which is going to be higher than in peacetime, which is what we'll be discussing today. One extra thing to note here is that the Daring class brought some amenities that had not been on previous vessels. Those include air conditioning. That's nice. Okay. I mean, my apartment right now does not have air conditioning, so this ship built in the 50s is nicer than my apartment. It also had bunks rather than hammocks.
Okay, so it's like definitely more than what we think of today when you see, like, you know, like behind the scenes of a Navy ship. Like
it's your, like, really more like that. It's like your fancy boutique destroyer. I'm going to read a little bit from the Voyager's Welcome Aboard brochure.
Okay. Is this like a period document, actually, from like the 50s?
It is. And I don't know what this means. This is from the Royal Australian Navy website about the Voyager.
Okay.
I don't know if this is something that was like given to new people coming on the ship. If this is like something, you know, that was placed on your pillow the first time you got to your bunk. I don't know what this was. But this is just basic information about the ship itself. So I'll be quoting fairly extensively from this for a few minutes. Quote, "This class of ship is a departure from the conventional destroyer, both in general design, armament, and number of personnel carried. She has the striking power of a light cruiser, coupled with the latest anti-submarine weapon and detection devices. Furthermore, her maneuverability is superior to that of even the most modern conventional destroyer, owing to the fitting of twin rudders. Main machinery and boilers are arranged in what is known as the unit system. Each shaft is driven by its own engine room and boiler room, though these can be interconnected if required. Action damage to the main machinery is therefore more localized than in the conventional destroyer arrangement of only one engine room." Remember this part.
Yeah, that actually is an interesting concept, like to kind of make it modular so that, you know, if you did receive damage in a battle or something, like, you're not just done if one of your engine rooms floods. Like, you'd have multiple.
I remember asking this question, I think, on the Sultana episode. You know, when I was young and stupid and didn't know anything about boiler systems in ships. And asking, you know, can one boiler explode and the other one be okay? The answer then was no. The answer here,
yes.
Maybe yes. Hopefully yes. So I thought that was really interesting to see kind of the progression, you know, not just technology, but just kind of the way that we conceptualize risk. What do we want to do with these ships? Another important part that could be important later, still quoting here. An integral part of the ship's efficiency as a fighting unit is her communications. Voyager is equipped with the latest radio electronic equipment capable of transmitting and receiving messages to and from anywhere in the world. In addition, she's able to talk to both ships and aircraft by radio telephone on all frequencies in common use. All this equipment can be controlled from gas-tight compartments and can be run off batteries if electrical power fails. Signals can also be passed to and from ships in visual range by means of flags and signaling lamps.
Interesting. A lot of this stuff, you know, it doesn't seem that, like, groundbreaking now, because I think you would just assume that naval ships can do a lot of this stuff. But at the time, a lot of this stuff has to be fairly kind of cutting edge.
Yeah, one of the things on this ship that was mentioned in its kind of its initial brochure, I guess is the best word for it, is the fact that, you know, this is the dawning of the nuclear era. Ships at this point have to be built to sustain weaponry and method of attack that didn't have to be considered in some of our earlier warships.
Right.
So here, this is a big deal, having this, what was supposed to be a radiation safe, you know, gas resistant chamber in this ship where you could do all of the basic things you needed to do. So steering the ship, navigating, things like that could all be done from this, basically a bomb shelter on the ship. And this is a big selling point for these. They were kind of the new, well-prepared ship for the atomic era. And that communication, obviously, it, like you said, it seems basic to us now, but that's a big deal. You know, saying that you have the most updated, you have the most useful, any way that we can communicate now, this ship can do it, and it can do it well.
Yeah, I think just the idea of being able to communicate across the world in the 50s, like that, it's not like today where everything's like connected to the internet.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that they do still mention, hey, we still have all of the same capabilities that we used to. You know, back in the age of Nelson, we have flags, we have signaling lamps, we have all this stuff. We have many, many ways to communicate. So let's get to the incident in question for today's episode.
Hit me with that date.
All right, our date here, February 10th, 1964. February 10th, 1964.
All right.
So this night is reported as being moonless, but clear. So good visibility, not dealing with things that we sometimes deal with, you know, fog, things of that nature. It's a pretty warm night. You know, we're talking about the coast of Australia, kind of that South Pacific type region. So the vessel at this point was under the command of D.H. Stevens.
Okay.
Aged 42, he had been an officer in the Navy since 1939. He served during World War II on cruisers and destroyers, and he had been in command of the Voyager since 1962.
So he sounds like he's pretty experienced.
So a pretty experienced person we're dealing with, who has experience on ships both in wartime and peacetime. You know, this is not a raw recruit that we're talking about here. This is someone with a good deal of experience. Interesting thing here, I kind of found out as I was reading about his life and the sort of Australian naval structure as a whole. He entered the Naval Academy in 1934. When I believe he was 14.
Okay, wow.
Which is very young, I feel like.
Yeah, that is extremely young.
For that to start. So he's basically graduating at the same age where we would kind of expect people to enter the Naval Academy, at least in, you know, the modern, at least speaking for the United States. So he has a lot of experience. You know, he has spent the bulk of his life on ships or learning about ships or learning how to command ships. So, like we said, a very experienced officer in command of the Voyager on the date in question. On this date, the Voyager and the HMAS Melbourne, an aircraft carrier, they were conducting maneuvers centered around night flying exercises. They were southeast of Jarvis Bay, Australia. So this is in the southeastern portion of the country. This is kind of between Sydney and Canberra. We're talking about the southeastern portion of the country. Jarvis Bay is the location also of the Royal Australian Naval College. So for American listeners, this is like the Annapolis, we'll say, of Australia. Mm-hmm. So on this night, I mentioned these nights flying maneuvers with the carrier. We had these three Gannet aircraft. Gannets were submarine hunters, and two Venoms, interceptors. I'm not a big Air Force person. I don't exactly know what that is for, but that's what we're dealing with here, these types of aircraft who are going to be taking off and landing on this carrier. So they were scheduled to conduct touch-and-go landing exercises. Had these been occurring during the daytime, the plane guard function would have been done by helicopter. But at night, just due to the extra risk of operating aircraft helicopters at night, this was done by destroyers when they did these at night.
Can you explain that plane guard?
Yeah, so plane guard is a relatively standardized function that I had to read a little bit about. I obviously kind of understood the concept, but a ship functioning as plane guard is essentially on call to pick up pilots who need to ditch in the event that, you know, something goes wrong with their landing.
Right. So it's more of like a just in case, like a search and rescue type.
Yeah, it's very much a, you know, having someone on standby in case something goes wrong. Best case scenario, the ship doing plane guard action doesn't have to actually do anything except for maintaining its position. Worst case scenario, you're picking up flyers who have ditched their plane into the water. So this is the function that the Voyager is serving on the night we're discussing here. Now, an interesting thing with plane guard is that the aircraft carrier itself is kind of the focal point. This is the whole reason that you're conducting this exercise, is so these planes can practice landing and taking off from the carrier. So the carrier obviously needs to be sensitive to wind direction, wind speed, things like that, to make it easier or more feasible for these planes to land and to take off. So they're making possibly frequent, possibly sudden changes in direction based on the wind. From everything I was able to read about this, there was a couple PowerPoints I looked through from like naval colleges, some articles. It seems like it very much is the role of the destroyer to keep a very, very close eye on what the carrier is doing. Obviously, the carrier is going to communicate its movements, but at the same time, the destroyer needs to be on its toes for what is the carrier doing, because they need to respond very, very quickly to these possibly small and sudden changes in the wind. So that's always going to be the task of the captain, but also the entire bridge crew on the destroyer who's running plane guard.
And that makes sense. I mean, a lot of times when you have these situations where there's a larger vessel and then there's smaller vessels around it, like, it's always kind of on the smaller vessels to see and avoid. Like, you have to basically defer to the larger, less maneuverable vessel.
It's like stopping your car on train tracks. It's like,
train's not stopping.
The train can't stop, so you need to get out of the way. But on this night, so these ships, they'd conducted several course changes of direction successfully, and the Voyager had maintained its correct, proper plane guard position. However, this is where our story gets interesting. A small aside here, this is one of those kind of, I don't know if it's rare, but it's a specific subset of stories where we know exactly what happened, and we have almost zero idea why. It's a very strange and it's a very frustrating story.
Yeah, because it is like extremely simple what's about to happen.
And we'll get to that. What is about to happen here? So at 8:52 p.m., Melbourne orders the Voyager to get back into plane guard position. Plane guard position, I don't know if I actually explained thoroughly before. This is to the rear of the carrier. So you're off either the port or starboard quarter of the carrier. You're to the rear of the vessel. This is so that if a pilot is in the water, you are coming up behind the ship and you are there to pick them up as soon as possible. So they're ordered to get back in that position after some other maneuvers. From the Voyager's initial position, and here by initial I mean in this small span of time that is relevant to the incident, the expected maneuver, the Voyager was kind of amidships, slightly ahead of Melbourne at this point. The expected maneuver would have been for Voyager to peel off to starboard and circle back behind the carrier to take up its position.
So basically, she would have been turning away from the carrier, but then back around towards her.
Turning away from the carrier, circling around, and then getting behind her. As we talked about before, the destroyer is much more maneuverable. It can do things like this a lot easier.
Right.
So circling around, getting in position behind the carrier. Voyager began this process as expected, pretty normally, turning to starboard, as everyone was expecting. For reasons that will probably never be known, the Voyager then reversed its turn, angling back to port, taking it right into the path of the Melbourne. At 8:56 p.m., Melbourne struck Voyager almost amidships on her port side, directly behind the bridge.
So pretty much like, right, like dead center?
Almost dead center, basically. The initial impact caused Voyager to roll to starboard briefly before shearing entirely in two.
So it literally cut through like the vessel.
Literally just cut it in half, essentially.
I don't think we've had that happen on any of the ones we've talked about.
I don't think so. And this
not
was,
directly anyway. Well, not like that.
This was extremely strange and interesting to me because yes, the collisions that we've talked about plenty of collisions so far, but they, you know, they typically don't have this effect. You don't have this disparity in size or strength of the ships. You know, one ship might hole the other ship and, you know, pull away. But here we just have an aircraft carrier cutting a destroyer in half.
Also, proud to say that Norwegian Navy was not involved.
No Norwegian. So props to them for staying out of this
one. Staying away from this collision.
For once. So the forward section of Voyager sank very quickly in about 10 minutes, I think most reports say. The aft portion remained afloat for actually a few hours.
So if you were in the aft section, I would say most likely your odds of survival.
You had a much, much better chance of surviving if you were in the aft section. The explanation I saw is that the forward section had the heavier guns, and so it basically went down as soon as it was severed from the rest of the ship. I guess I was honestly surprised that either half of the ship stayed afloat at all. I would have thought that both of them would have gone down. But no, the aft portion stayed afloat, and overwhelming majority of people there survived. So almost immediately, Melbourne realizes that something terrible has happened. They launch their rescue boats. They have lifeboats to deploy. In addition to Melbourne herself, there's 5 minesweepers, 2 search and rescue ships, and 8 helicopters in the area. Remember, this is a naval exercise they're doing.
Right. So they, as far as survival capabilities go, you've got a ton of it already on scene, it appears.
You're in one of the better situations you could be in terms of having personnel and equipment on scene for rescue. So of the 314 people on board the Voyager, 82 of them were killed. 14 of these were officers, 67 were enlisted. There was actually one civilian dock worker who was on board. I think he was observing some changes or refits that had been done to the ship, and he was also killed. Of all of those, only 3 bodies were recovered. Among them was Captain Stevens.
Okay.
That will possibly be important later in one of our later aspects of the story.
So I guess, like, I don't know, it's purely speculation, but I guess part of the explanation there could be that, I mean, if you were below decks in the forward part of the vessel, like, you didn't have time to get out, so you probably went down in there. You know what I mean? Like, you didn't have a chance to get, you know, to the top of the ship and, like, actually, you know, get in the water.
Right.
I imagine. Sort of like the Blackthorn. Like when we talk,
yeah, this
kind of reminds me of the Blackthorn.
This is an incident where most of the people who die in this incident are killed in the initial collision. By and large, people who made it off of the ship survived. Obviously, that's not a totally true statement for everyone. But essentially, the collision is what causes the fatalities here.
And I'm assuming that's why so many officers are killed. If it strikes it at midship, it's going to like slice through the bridge.
Exactly.
That's how like the captain
exactly.
is killed and stuff.
And that becomes extremely important for the second half of the story. Melbourne herself, the carrier, did suffer some pretty superficial damage, but no casualties from this collision. There was some damage to, I think, some different corridors and whatever, you know, at the bow of the ship, but no one was injured. No one was killed on the Melbourne. So, I mean, that's a small positive here, I guess. There's a picture, I think I showed it on Twitter the other night. You can see the bow of the Melbourne where it's kind of carved out. You can see that it's torn up,
yeah.
But you can also kind of see that there's no real structural damage to the ship.
Right. Like the bow kind of just absorbed the impact the way it was supposed to.
Mm-hmm. So after this, of course, we need to find out what happened. So a Royal Commission was conducted. I'll share a link to that Royal Commission report. This is interesting because this is one of the few accidents in a Commonwealth nation, possibly the only one, where we have two royal commissions conducted for this. So we'll talk about the first one first. You know, this was at the time, and it remains, the deadliest peacetime incident in the history of the Australian Armed Forces. So people wanted to know why this happened. Almost immediately, this became a really big news story. However, an interesting detail here, the Navy did not report this to the Australian Prime Minister Menzies, right away. From what I can see, they felt that they could keep this kind of in-house, saying we can deal with this ourselves, the investigation, dealing with the situation. This is a Navy issue, we'll handle it ourselves.
When you say they didn't tell him, like, they waited 5 hours, or they waited a day, or just like, he won't miss it?
From what I could see, he found out about it the following day on the news, along with most other Australians.
I would be pretty angry if I was in charge of a country and I found out that I lost a Navy ship.
And it seems that he was. He was very upset with that. Again, the time frame, I could be mistaken with my time frame. Remember, this happened late at night, so probably the next morning news. I believe that's when he found out about it.
Right. I mean, I guess it is also the 50s. I know we touched on it with like the Thresher thing, where like the ship that's out there with the Thresher doesn't report the Thresher missing for like 6 hours, even though like they basically know what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the like 60s, we're dealing with the 60s here now. But yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. Like everyone is reliant on what the news is telling them. And if you're not getting it through your, you know, back government channels, you're going to find out like everyone else. So a Royal Commission was put together under the leadership of John Armstrong Spicer. Spicer did have some experience before overseeing investigations into aviation accidents previous years, in 1960 and 1961. This commission found fault with both vessels' officers, assigning blame to the Voyager for her erratic actions, but also to Melbourne for her failure to communicate and take proper steps to avoid a collision. So I'm going to quote here from a write-up from the Australian National University. Quote, Spicer concluded that the collision would not have occurred if a proper watch had been maintained in Voyager. Because he could not reconstruct events on the destroyer's bridge, he felt unable to determine responsibility of any of her officers for what had occurred. In contrast, he criticized Captain R.J. Robertson and other officers in Melbourne for not questioning Voyager's movements before a dangerous situation developed. Robertson was posted ashore.
They did the opposite. They did the opposite of the normal thing, which is normally everyone blames the dead guy.
Blame the dead captain. That's you know, standard operating procedure here.
Yeah, like he flipped it. He's like, well, I can't blame him. He's dead. So I guess this is your fault.
And this does become much more nuanced with more things that come out later. But a lot of people had kind of a similar reaction, saying that, why are we blaming the captain of this carrier?
Right.
Who essentially couldn't have done a whole lot here. You know, if this vessel steers in front of him, what's he expected to do?
Well, it's kind of like going back to that analogy with like the train, like you can't blame the train for hitting the car that's stuck on the train tracks. Mm-hmm. Like it's what the train does.
This was not super well received from what I saw.
I imagine.
People were not super satisfied with this conclusion. Captain Robertson resigned his commission rather than accept his demotion, which is a big deal. He was forfeiting, obviously, his salary, his job, but also a pretty significant pension by doing that.
Yeah, I'm assuming what they thought they could do is basically punish him and he could be the scapegoat, but they could be like, hey, don't take it too hard. Like, just do your things and you'll still be fine, like, personally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
apparently he didn't want that.
And again, you know, not being an insider at all to the case, but it's at least evidence to what Robertson thought about his own actions that he would resign rather than accept blame for this.
Right.
So that happened. You know, he resigned. A few years later, there was a second Royal Commission.
Okay.
Again, this is not a normal thing. We don't normally have two of these Royal Commissions. Why this happened, though, is interesting. So after that verdict in the first commission, which again was always intended to be the only commission, allegations surfaced that Captain Stevens of the Voyager was frequently drunk on duty or incapacitated due to, you know, subsequent effects of being drunk before duty.
This is what I expect. Like, this is how the blame normally happens in these things.
Yeah, so the details of the second commission are interesting, and why it happened and who testifies and who gives evidence is very interesting here. So these were brought forward by Peter Caban, who had been he had been an officer on Voyager. He had served under Captain Stevens. He was not on the vessel the night of this incident, however. Mm-hmm. That is an important detail that is frequently brought up here, is that he had served with him, but he was not present for the collision.
Right. So, like, even if the captain's a drunk, like, you can't prove that he was drunk here.
As we'll see, you know, for anyone who wants to look at the articles and the documentary links that I'll post, it at least strikes me that the evidence against Captain Stevens is at best circumstantial.
Mm-hmm.
So these allegations are detailed in a documentary called Unfit to Command. I'll share a link to that. It's on YouTube. Again, what I've watched and read, they seem to be relatively uncorroborated, at least in terms of him being drunk while he's in command. Obviously, behavior in port while, you know, you're off duty, that could be a totally different matter. But I think that one might be excused for kind of falling back on the stereotypical view of the drunken sailor.
Right, even if it happens to be the captain of the vessel.
If your ship stops in Singapore and you have too much to drink and you're hungover the next day, that's kind of standard operating procedure, at least from a stereotype perspective. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're drinking on the job.
Right.
Is it possible? Of course. It's not proof. One of the interesting testimonies here, though, is that a steward who had been on the Voyager,
mm-hmm.
claimed that the captain allegedly had a steward, or had him, bring him a triple brandy in the hours before the fatal collision. Triple brandy. It's a lot of...
It's a lot of brandy.
That's a fair amount of alcohol to have.
Yes, it is. Brandy, of all things.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about brandy here. However, Alan Hellier, who was a senior radio operator on the Voyager at the time,
mm-hmm.
So he was actually present on the ship at the time.
Okay, so he was on the vessel when the collision happened?
Yes.
Okay.
He claims, in an interview with The Guardian, again, I'll share a link to that as well, he claims that the brandy was for him, not for the captain. The reason for this brandy might surprise you. Why would you drink brandy?
I wouldn't really drink a whole lot of brandy.
It's probably the best answer. I wouldn't.
I guess if I wanted to get drunk for a very cheap price, but also wanted to have a awful hangover the next day.
According to Hellier, the brandy was for him because he had been sick on the bridge. He was friends with the captain. The captain ordered him a triple brandy to settle his stomach.
I thought ginger ale did that.
I've had some brandy, not good brandy, but cheap brandy in my day, and I feel like the opposite of that is what happens.
I mean, isn't all brandy cheap, by the way? Isn't good brandy cognac?
Yeah. Maybe it's a different time, different place. Brandy is probably the last thing I want if I want to settle my stomach.
I want like a ginger ale or a Sprite or something like that.
So, I don't know. Maybe this was standard operating procedure. that's the testimony here.
Maybe the captain just took a little sip every time he walked past the radio station. Who knows?
Maybe. This same radio operator, he you know, says he knew the captain. He never knew him to be drunk. Certainly never on the bridge. So we have one person's word against another, basically, when it comes to this captain. Ultimately, the second commission found no grounds for the claims that Stevens was incapacitated by alcohol at the time, but they did find that the Voyager was at fault for the collision. Interesting detail here, Stevens' medical state was called into question and partially blamed for this. This medical condition being an ulcer condition, quote,
okay,
to which his drinking habits contributed.
Hmm.
So what that exactly means, who knows? I could easily see that being essentially Navy code for, yes, this guy was drunk, but we're not going to say that.
Right. They're just acknowledging that, like, alcohol played a detrimental role in his health.
Basically. Right. It seems like an easy sort of somewhat middle ground to take there. Mm. I don't know. Again, the only real conclusion here that can be drawn is that a mistake was made on the bridge of the Voyager. How this happened, who made this mistake, wasn't established, and it probably never will be. The main real thing here is that the captain and crew of the Melbourne were exonerated of any wrongdoing, negligence. They did nothing wrong, essentially. Which is, I mean, it's a big change to the story. It doesn't necessarily give closure, because we still don't know why. You know, did someone hear a coordinate wrong? Was the captain drunk? It doesn't really satisfy any of those claims, but it does at least take some blame away from people who maybe didn't deserve it.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Once more, we'll go back to that that radio operator, Alan Hellier. So his claim for the reason behind the accident, quoting from that article, the cause of the collision could have been a misinterpretation of a course and speed direction given by the Melbourne, possibly complicated by a dropout of radio signal. If the Voyager had been given a course and speed that would steer it across the bow of the Melbourne, Voyager should have queried it because that was never done.
Mm-hmm.
Quoting directly from Hellier, we had never been asked to cross the bow of an aircraft carrier. Very often, they do give wrong directions. You always have to be on the ball when you're working with a carrier. If you got that order, you'd automatically query it and ask the skipper.
Interesting. The first thing I think of is, like, I think we say this for most of these incidents, like, it's never one thing that goes wrong. So, like, what was the conversation between the carrier and the destroyer? Like, or the, yeah, the Voyager and the Melbourne. Like, what did they talk about? Was something flipped? Was the wrong direction given? Was the wrong message relayed to the, you know, helmsman? It's just very unlikely that one thing caused this.
It's an interesting detail that comes up in the first commission report, where they talk to other officers who had worked with carriers and destroyers. And they're pretty adamant about the fact that, you know, there were basically two things needed to happen. The carrier needed to give the new flying direction coordinates, like how they were going to change course, and they also needed to issue coordinates to the destroyer. The thing in question is basically, as the captain of the destroyer, would he have taken the flying coordinates, or the flight path coordinates, as his new position coordinates,
mm-hmm,
or would he have waited for new coordinates? And that's kind of something that they didn't fully hammer down from what I could see, but it really seemed from a lot of the testimony of the naval personnel that the idea of it being a bad coordinate or a misheard or misdirected coordinate seems very unlikely, because basically multiple steps of misinterpretation would have had to happen.
Right.
It wouldn't just be one thing and then they do it. It would have been this coordinate and then a confirmation and then another coordinate for this other direction and then another confirmation. I don't know. It seems like a very odd situation where it's very hard to establish what happened. One of the most logical explanations I saw was the idea of fishtailing. Did I talk about fishtailing already?
No, I don't think so.
So one of the most logical explanations that I read and saw about this was, if you remember, closer to the beginning of the episode, I talked about the kind of standard procedure of just a straight circling off to starboard and coming around behind the ship. Another option that was mentioned was the idea of fishtailing. So you take this initial turn off to starboard, and then you come back to port. You go back to starboard, you come back to port. You go back to starboard, you come back to port. It slows you down, so you can basically just fall behind the carrier.
You're just kind of, like, letting it get ahead of you. So you're back in, like, that plane watch position.
It takes a little bit longer, and that's most of the reasons why I saw that it wasn't normally done. It was inefficient. There's no real reason to do it. There's no advantage. So possibly what happened is that the carrier thought that's what they were doing when they turned back to port, and so they didn't necessarily respond to it.
Right.
You know, until they crossed that certain critical threshold, it wasn't a problem because it was something that was potentially doable. Again, this comes back to communication. A statement I read from a more senior commander who basically said that had he been in position, if he was the captain of the Melbourne, he would have immediately questioned what the Voyager was doing. But he sort of added the caveat of, you know, that's my opinion now. I've been in the Navy for, you know, decades. I've commanded these types of ships. For a commander, like the commander of the Melbourne at the time, this was his first time being in tactical command of multiple ships. He somewhat rightly maybe wouldn't have been expected to take that sort of initiative. He may not have noticed immediately that this was something strange happening or that it wasn't standard procedure.
Right. And I think the one thing I'm kind of picturing at this point is you think that maybe they're doing the port to starboard maneuver back and forth to slow down. And before you know it, you're like, well, what are they doing? And then it's too late. And you see that even in some of the other collision stories where ships assume the other one's doing what they're supposed to do. And then when you're like, oh, why are they right there? You don't have time to avoid them.
Right. And it comes down to it's always that balance between risk aversion, but then also trying to do your job. You can't call for a halt every time something minor happens that is, you know, outside of what exactly you're expecting.
Right.
But here, I think the expectation from a more senior captain would have been immediately questioning, what is this destroyer doing? Quicker than it happened. Because there was a question about what the Voyager was doing, but it was obviously way too late for what was happening. So yeah, a lot of things up in the air, a lot of things that really just come down to experience and kind of what different people would do in that situation. But again, ultimately, just from the pretty brief research that I did about this, it doesn't seem like you can blame the captain of the Melbourne too harshly. I don't know. That's kind of what I come away with here.
I mean, it definitely seems like, again, it's one of those things where there's no one answer, but I don't think blaming the crew and the captain of the Melbourne is the right angle to take. Could they have done more to avoid it? Probably. But also when you're having to factor in aircraft retrieval and things like that, like, I don't think that you're going to expect one of your escort ships to cut right in front of you, like where you're clearly sailing.
Yeah, it's, I mean, like anyone who's had a job with, you know, subordinates under you, there's always that situation where you're like, ah, I can deal with this, this, and this, but I cannot worry about this other thing. Like, that has to be your job.
Like, I'm going to assume that you're going to do the things that you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Without a problem.
Yeah. But, interestingly enough, this is not the last incident the Melbourne would be involved in.
Oh no.
And it's very bizarre. This is not the first ship we've talked about where it is involved in multiple incidents. You know, in the Whaleback episode, we talked about ships that were, you know, sunk three or four times. The weird thing about this, Melbourne returned to service, but she has another incident. Another incident that is eerily, shockingly similar to this one. It involves another destroyer, and it involves that destroyer getting cut in half.
That is strangely similar.
And we will discuss that more on our Patreon episode.
Nice.
For this month. I'll talk about that with Katie. Well, probably talk about Katie also a little bit. Introduce her a little bit. But yeah, we'll talk about that incident with Katie on the bonus episode for this month.
It's kind of exciting to get some of that supplemental stuff, you know, onto Patreon.
I was going to just squeeze it into this episode. but it's kind of long as is. And she's just like, let's just do the bonus episode about that. And I was like, that's a great idea.
That is a good idea.
So final thoughts, go through this quick. This one was weird because there's a lot of conflicting testimony. There's a lot of like really hardcore support for both sides. People who really want to blame the captain of the Melbourne, people who really want to blame the captain of the Voyager. Very strong support for both sides. So conflicting testimony, difficult to really establish exactly what happened. We will probably never know. Like many accidents, obviously you can probably assign a small portion of blame to almost every party. But, you know, one isolated mistake rarely causes a catastrophe like this. One small error doesn't do this, because if someone questions that, if at any point in this sequence, you know, anyone on the bridge of Voyager questions the bearing that they're taking, or if anyone on the bridge of Melbourne is more active in asking Voyager what they're doing, this doesn't happen. It's you can kind of parse out the blame to multiple parties. At the end of the day, obviously, a general consensus is that the captain of the Voyager, or the bridge crew of the Voyager, is ultimately responsible for what happened. And that's regardless of why. You know, that's not to say that D.H. Stevens was drunk at the time, or that anyone was being negligent. There's other ways to make mistakes, but all those things considered, that's what happened. And right. That's kind of where the blame has to fall.
It's weird having one of these where you really don't have a solid why. Like, we know exactly what, and so often the what is the thing that we don't know with a lot of these shipwrecks. But in this case, we know exactly what happened. It's just getting to why that is so frustrating.
Right.
One of the things I think of in all this, and it's hard to know it without so much of the crew, you know, here to testify, but it just seems like an example of crew or bridge resource management not being done properly, because these are the kind of problems that happen. That's how you have those multiple like failure modes over and over and over again, is when you have a poor use of like the bridge resource management techniques. And that's really what this seems like. And we can't prove that people were distracted or afraid to speak up, but clearly, you know, maybe there was someone on board the Voyager that knew that they were doing something wrong. Maybe they didn't feel empowered to speak up, or maybe they did and they were ignored. You know, if you're just an enlisted guy or a junior officer, are you really going to walk up to the captain that has a reputation for being a drunk and probably angry and like correct him? Probably not.
Yeah, there is some testimony from people who had been on the watch at the time that's quite interesting. And they were kind of asked similar questions by the counsel or the investigators for the case. And they had similar responses saying, you know, when you're in this position, when you're on the watch, you know, recently commissioned officer, when you're on the watch, your job is not to give details about where ships are or what their coordinates are. Your job is to, you know, tell someone when you saw something new, basically.
Right.
If something changes,
they deal with it from there.
Exactly. It's a lot of moving pieces here, obviously. For sure. It's a fascinating and frustrating story, I'll say.
For sure. It definitely is.
But I think that's all we have for now. We will talk more about the Melbourne on the Patreon episode as we talk about its collision with the USS Frank E. Evans, where there are some, like I said, eerie similarities, but also some differences in what may have happened in that situation. Tune in for that.
Yep.
I did also share the last month's bonus episode about the perfect storm for everyone on Twitter and Instagram.
And that one is actually unlocked on Patreon, correct?
Yes, that one is unlocked. So anyone can listen to that one. It's just a link to an MP3 file.
Great. Perfect. That'll be good. That can kind of give you guys like an idea of what the bonus content's going to look like. We'll be doing different things as well. It won't always be a movie. Like, it'll sometimes be an extension of something that we talk about on here. But it's definitely worth checking out.
All right. So for everyone, thank you for listening. And have a good week. And we will be back next week with more stuff for you.